Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I discuss the question, can you have a good day on purpose? We define what we mean by good day. We discuss the very real challenges and obstacles that can prevent us from having a good day. Explore the biological variables at play when trying to have a good day, summarize the positive psychology literature on things like subjective well-being, give some practical strategies and tips for how to cultivate a good day on purpose, and of course, much, much more. If any of you listening are looking for good training and education pursuant to becoming a psychedelic therapist, check out Numinous's programs. You can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection and use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. I actually had a great time this morning teaching Module 3 of our Fundamentals of Psychedelic-Assisted Therapy course, discussing core therapist skills for psychedelic-assisted therapy. So please, if you're interested at all, at least check out the link. And of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by subscribing to the show. Most podcast players have a little follow or subscribe button there. That will ensure that you get updates on new episodes. You can leave us a review in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And of course, you can share the episode with somebody you think could use a good day. Please enjoy today's episode. Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. How you doing, Reed?
Pretty dang good.
Good. I just noticed I said that intro in a sigh. I'm actually doing pretty good too. Today we're going to explore and try to answer the question, can you have a good day on purpose?
Why the sigh, Steve?
You know, let me tell the story about how we came up with this topic. So I was having a rough day yesterday, tired and, busy, a little stressed. And my wife knew it because, she loves me and she sent me this TikTok, and it was this person giving basically a pep talk, like, you can do it, go for it, et cetera, et cetera. It was really, really great, high energy. And at the end of the TikTok, she says, go out there and have a good day on purpose. And I was like, huh, a good day on purpose. It sort of summons all my old training around positive psychology. And it made me wonder, you know, what are the things that are in the way of us having a good day on purpose? Can you have a good day on purpose? I think the short answer is yes, but we're just going to try to talk about it in detail and hopefully give some useful tips about how to have a good day on purpose.
Yeah, the short answer is yes. What's coming to mind are all the things out of our control and in the way of having a good day, or the negative mood states that we work with so much at work in, like, major depressive disorder that can be overwhelmingly difficult to live through.
Right. Yeah. I think that's an important place to start because you know, there's this notion of toxic positivity out there.
Yeah.
Where, you know, no matter what happens to you, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, look on the bright side, be optimistic, you know, don't dwell, and go out there and force yourself to have a good day on purpose.
And force yourself.
Yeah, right. We're not in the business of suppression, repression, or denial. We don't want to be in denial of the very reality of our suffering. So we want to make sure that as we set the table for this conversation, that we acknowledge some of the caveats, I guess, to having a good day on purpose and try to avoid falling into toxic positivity.
Yeah. And this is not a podcast episode to just share our cool morning routines that everyone should do.
You know, it's funny. My brothers and I have this group chat with just us. And one of my brothers this morning sent this parody video First it was a video of a guy on a podcast talking about his morning routine. And it should have been a parody. It was hilariously.
It was real.
It was real. But it was like, get up at 4 a.m., stare at the sun for, you know, 7 minutes. And then at this time I run on the treadmill while I'm, you know, drinking my coffee and planning my day and doing my affirmations with my wife. And it was just like, holy cow, how do you have time to do anything else? It just seemed pretty intense. I'm sure it works for this guy. But then I shared another one that was an actual parody where this guy's, you know, he's pulling on the Huberman stuff and he's, you know, start your side hustle, don't break your fast, you know, make 40K, start another side hustle, kind of mocking this notion of hustle culture and being ridiculously ambitious in that way.
Yeah. While we're on this topic, there's something to be said about structure, right? Like as human beings, we're wired to feel chaos and disorder as more uncomfortable than order, just as a general foundation. So there is something to be said about getting up and doing some kind of routine, about making your bed, not just because, well, there are some ripple effects from little acts like that, I think because of how we're wired. But there's a fine line there, like a middle path to walk of over control is also the source of so much suffering.
Right. Yeah. It brings to mind, you know, love him or hate him, Jordan Peterson's recommendation to clean your room. Right. And he's gotten a lot of mileage out of that simple directive, but the spirit of it being, I think, like you said, with making your bed, add some structure, even if it's small or seemingly innocuous, like cleaning your room. And then that does, it can set the tone for a day, for example, or it can invite in a sense of security and safety and predictability in what otherwise, like you were saying, might be chaotic.
Mm-hmm. Clean your room. Yesterday, one of my 14-year-old twins detailed my car.
Oh, cool.
So I got to drive in here in a freshly detailed car. He's working on a side hustle in his morning routine. I'm just kidding. No, it's... Yeah, it's fun to see kids get an entrepreneurial bug or have an idea and work on it. And it's kind of fun to see it in up against his twin brother's different side hustle, too.
That's cool. Yeah. So I want to make sure that we do acknowledge some of those caveats that I mentioned. So it can be really difficult to have a good day on purpose when, for example, you are oppressed, or you're the victim of violence or abuse, or you're in poverty, or you have a serious mental illness, or you're feeling alienated and isolated. You have a physical disability. I've got a list here of things I just thought about. If for a variety of reasons, you feel very, very powerless, we want to make sure that if any of you are listening and you know you have these experiences, that you don't let the pendulum swing too far to the other side to it's all up to me. It's all about me. The reason I'm suffering is because I don't have the right mindset. If only I had the right mindset, then I wouldn't be suffering. Because there can be a lot of shame and sort of self-flagellation when you've fallen into that trap of toxic positivity and you assume that you ought to be happy, right? That that is the penultimate value, and we should be experiencing bliss and happiness all the time, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
I've seen that so much in people, not just clients, like so many people I've interacted with and observed it myself that I should be fill in the blanks, like you're shooting on yourself. And that's a self-critical thing. And that is, of course, you know, associated with some negative affective states and some, a war within.
Yeah. I was feeling it yesterday, you know, even despite the pep talk TikTok. I had a full day and it was a productive day. And I got to the end of it and I was feeling really, really tired and started to get a little discouraged and down and was captured by that negative affective state and started to have some really intrusive negative thoughts. And fortunately, I was able to resource and acknowledge that, you know, it's not that I was doing anything wrong or that anything in my life was particularly wrong. I was just tired. And it's okay to be tired at the end of a long work day. And maybe I just needed rest, right? Maybe I didn't need to jazz up a positive mental attitude. But orient to my commitments to be present for my kids when I got home and, you know, be present for my wife to the extent that I could, but also communicate like, hey, Dad's tired. I need to take a little breather before I reengage.
Yeah, and that goes a long way, just being open about how we feel. But I think the weather is kind of a good analogy. It was raining when we started, and I think you mentioned it, but I think of mood states sometimes as weather patterns, and we have no control over like a gloomy day where it's just dark and cloudy, and that feels ominous, and it gets in the way of what we want to do, and that happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, for so many reasons. Like it can be from circumstances. It can be from, you know, neurochemical mood states coming out of nowhere, hormonally influenced, is such a big thing. Like, we're not a flat line of one steady mood throughout the course of a day, a week, a month, or a year. And there's seasonal variation, all that.
Such a good point. Such an important point, right? We're not, human beings are dynamic beings. And I've been amazed, as a non-physician, right? You're a psychiatrist, I'm a psychologist. Starting my training, not focusing on the neurobiological pieces. I mean, classes in neurobiology and that kind of stuff, but focusing more on the psychological behavioral stuff. It frequently amazes me how much a neurochemical change can affect who a person is, right? Given the right medicine and their lives are different, or they come off the wrong medicine and their lives are different. Or you mentioned hormones, having clients who have thyroid dysfunction, for example.
Yeah.
And your thyroid being off can make the difference between I feel all right to I'm having intrusive suicidal thoughts. Mm-hmm. Right? Just because this chemical or this organ in your throat isn't functioning properly.
Yeah. Another example that we encounter plenty in clinic and that people talk about a lot online these days is testosterone. Mm-hmm. Like that, I think Andrew Huberman or others would say is a hormone that makes effort feel good. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so often overlooked what a low testosterone level can do to one's mood. Because if effort doesn't feel good at all, you avoid it. And that is one part of this thing we're talking about, of a sense of well-being that includes a lot of factors that we can dive into. But before we go off on neurochemical or kind of psychological subjective well-being tangents, you said something I want to rewind to of resources. Mm-hmm. And it just made me think that all that being said, negative mood states can come out of nowhere and they can be debilitating. And it's also important to keep in mind that we often do have some control over what happens next. Mm-hmm. Like there, even in a place of really low mood or suffering, it can be made a little worse, a little better, a lot worse, a lot better, based on how we navigate it.
Yeah. Yeah. It pays off to take inventory of what you are in control of and what you are not in control of, and mm-hmm. give yourself grace based on that inventory. It also can be really empowering, right? When you can make that distinction and then you see, there's actually more that I'm in control of than I thought. And there's some big long levers that I can pull that could really change this negative mood state, if not totally transform it, at least help me endure it.
Yeah. I'm glad you shared the origin story of the topic, because when you suggested it, and I'll just admit to our listeners, this is in a text last night,
yeah.
right? and when you suggested it, my immediate response was, cool, but what about XYZ, launching into these disclaimers that we've just talked about. But with all that out of the way, it's such an important thing to look at thriving and not just illness, at like well-being and not just disorders. And, you know, we're learning more and more about the human brain, applying it more to like drug development and treatments and diagnostics. But what about flourishing? What about wellness and harmony and ease, not just dis-ease? So yeah, like you said, the positive psychology field has, I think, been, a passionate pursuit to follow and, you know, contribute to for us both in ways over the past many years.
Yeah. I remember being exposed to it in graduate school and feeling really inspired by it. In part because as a clinical psychologist, right, my training is in mental illnesses, mental health conditions, you know, how the psyche deteriorates, how helping people go from a disordered or disorganized or diseased state to baseline. And there wasn't as much focus on what you're talking about, on thriving, on, mm-hmm. Dare I say, optimizing wellness. We need to be careful with that word optimization, but...
Yeah. So maybe we can just review a quick history of that or deconstruct some terms? Before we even get into Martin Seligman,
old Marty,
at UPenn, who's was president of the Psychological Association a couple decades ago and really pushed forward in that role and beyond in research and coursework and books of this positive psychology movement. But I think it was like in 84, Ed Diner's work, who really deconstructed subjective well-being as a concept. Because what do we mean when we talk about having a good day or good days or happiness or positive psychology? The term that I think at least academically captures it pretty well is this, or some of it is subjective well-being, that is made up of basically having you know, as much positive mood state as you can, as little negative mood state as you can, and satisfaction with your life.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those three components mainly.
There you go. And it's like you, like the model alludes to, and like you've pointed out a couple times already, it's not just about being happy, right? Happiness or joy are emotions. They're mood states, like you said. And we've talked about on the podcast before that a so-called negative mood does not mean that it's a necessarily unhealthy mood. We've made the distinction between normative sadness and, like, for example, and the importance, the message that sadness can bring that we want to heed and we want to act on versus something like, you know, depression.
Yeah.
Or despair.
Yeah. So an emotion tangent that we've gone on many times before, but for any new listeners, just a brief one. I like what you pointed out about sadness. And it just reminds me of the plug that we want to embrace our emotions. You know, sometimes you have to feel worse for a moment to feel better. Like you do have to feel it to move through it. And in addition to that, emotions are signals from within us that give us information of how to navigate life in a way that moves us towards health and well-being. And so yesterday, when you felt sad, and felt it in your body, and you recognized it, sluggish, slow, maybe you had a lump in your stomach or a knot or something. But then that kind of oriented you to this underlying need of reaching out to your wife who provided comfort.
Yeah. I mean, really, this is a important part of having a good day on purpose is becoming aware of our emotional states, becoming or being accepting as we explore and identify what's going on, and then taking action, right? Then addressing the unmet need that the emotion is signaling.
Yeah, because sometimes our inner frustrations, aka things that are in the way of feeling some of that, like subjective well-being, might be repressed or unexpressed emotions, or a mix of undifferentiated emotions that we haven't let out. Like, you could have a lot of anger that you haven't spoken about or expressed in a way that's important, that might be important for speaking your truth and exerting boundaries or protecting what's important to you. So just as one other example that comes to mind.
Yeah. So bookmark that as a point of how to have a good day on purpose. We need to become aware of and accepting and acknowledging and addressing the emotions.
Yeah.
These aren't bad emotions. The so-called negative emotions are not necessarily damaging, especially if we can listen to them and do what you're describing, not suppress, repress, or avoid.
Yeah. And to recap, clarify the three parts of subjective well-being from that original, like, positive psychology wave of understanding. The first one would be called evaluative well-being, which is how satisfied are you with your life, your job. And then the next one is a fun one because I just get a kick out of the term hedonic. Hedonic well-being is feelings or moods that have a positive affect, like pleasure and rapture and ecstasy, warmth, comfort, etc. So you could see how just focusing on that one might be recipe for how to have as pleasant of a life as possible. But we'll talk about why that's just a part of the puzzle. And then the third is eudaimonic well-being.
Eudaimonia.
That is judgment about the meaning and purpose of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is a whole nother important part that is sometimes overlooked in just evaluating moment to moment how we feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like this that you had that thought or reflection on the word hedonism or mm-hmm. hedonic. I remember in philosophy classes talking about, you know, are people just like animals constantly seeking to avoid pain and accumulate pleasure? There's also this concept of the hedonic treadmill, right? If we're just focused on pleasure, we're adaptation machines, so we can acclimate to the pleasure mm-hmm. on this treadmill, and then we're seeking the next fix, we're seeking the next level. And if we're disconnected from these other aspects that you talked about, then it's kind of a recipe for misery, actually.
Yeah. And there are kind of neurobiological mechanisms in the way of that focus being effective, like hedonic adaptation or whatever, just like the constant pursuit of dopamine spikes doesn't lead to like an infinite lasting supply of dopamine, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, there are some challenges that happen when you're seeking that excessively.
You know, I had a funny thought the other day when I was sort of contemplating the solemnities of eternity and whether or not there's life after this one. Like, wouldn't it be interesting if heaven was, this is such a tangent, but it's just a mm-hmm. thought that I had. Wouldn't it be interesting if heaven was the absence of hedonic adaptation? If we could just level up and for eternity, it just kept getting better and better and better. I mean, that's again, sort of a hedonist view of what heaven might look like.
Isn't that heavenly hedonic, I mean, ecstatic rapture or something? Isn't that how it works?
Sounds good
to me. What the plan says.
Yeah. Yeah. Sign me up for that version of heaven.
Yeah. But on the eudaimonic front, AKA purpose in life, feeding into your well-being, it reminds me of the very old adage, know thyself. You know, the scene in The Matrix where Neo goes into the kitchen of the Oracle, and in Latin is inscribed know thyself above like the doorway. And interestingly, in ancient Greece, in like the Temple of Apollo or whatever, there was a woman oracle who was sought out before any important decision was made about your personal life or who to attack next in your wars as a leader of a civilization or whatever. But it just reminds me that you do need, like Neo needed some baseline awareness of himself to know how to navigate the situations that he was put in according to his destiny or dharma, if you will. And, you know, not to get all dharma on any of this, but if you don't feel like your career is calling you, one strategy or fulfilling you, one strategy is to look at something, do something that helps you learn more about yourself and what lights you up. In some of these positive psychology courses at UPenn and at Yale especially, there's even a free one at Yale that some people can take, that I think anyone can take, and they have you do the VIA character strengths test before, scientifically validated questionnaire. It takes 10 minutes, 240 questions across like 24 areas of character strengths, and it gives you your top ones that can be really important in how to navigate your life in a way that increases your sense of meaning and purpose.
Mm. That's cool. You know what? One thought that I have when you talk about knowing yourself and self-development is a potential pitfall there with being too preoccupied with self.
Yeah.
Going back to kind of the it's all up to me idea. We're certainly prone to that in the West, especially America. We have this individualistic capitalistic society that, that tends to promote a belief like that, that, you know, my task is to really know me, hone, sharpen, and optimize me so that I can have a meaningful life. But I think part of a meaningful life is kind of like you were referencing with Neo, is knowing your role or what can give life meaning is knowing that you and your actions and your existence makes a difference in the lives of others, or it's connected to or related to, relevant to a grander purpose, you know, that transcend, not only transcends you, it might even transcend your community, your family, and even mortal life.
Yeah. And an example I've heard given, is really an interesting one because, you know, apparently it's pretty well established in the kind of social sciences literature that, that couples with children are on average, less likely to be happy than couples without children. And if evolution really relied on maximizing our happiness, you know, the human race would have died out long ago, right? Yet humans keep reproducing and deciding to have kids, sometimes lots of kids, even though there's this growing body of literature saying, like, that's not going to increase your quote unquote happiness by this definition. So there must be something else driving them besides like these positive mood states. And I think that's where that last component, the meaning and purpose, comes in.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly possible that humans are not just hedonistic robots.
It's possible.
Certainly possible. Yeah. Also, it seems like if we were to take a literalist's interpretation or a reductionist interpretation of evolution, it's for people, it seems like evolution is not selected for happiness in the human organism. If anything, it's selected for survival. So like we're scared of stuff. We, even in our modern life, we get scared of things that aren't necessarily physical threats, that can lead to anxiety or PTSD, you know?
Yeah. And in addition to that, we're wired for survival through dopamine, which, you know, in my best view of the brain and evolution and genetics is exists to propagate the human species, like to survive and reproduce. So what we might think of as happiness, like I think we need to filter out from these temporary spikes of dopamine that we get from eating or from having sex or from things like that, that are there to propagate the species. And when that wears off, there is the baseline soup of other neurochemicals that also can feel like unhappiness when you compare it to a dopamine rush.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that dopamine phenomenon you're talking about. It's almost as if, you know, if that wasn't the case, if we didn't have this molecule of more prompting us to strive and build and not be satisfied with where we are, that we would have stalled out as a species a long time ago. You know, human beings tend to be dissatisfied with where they are. And as a result, I mean, a lot of terrible things happen as a result of that, but also we keep going, we keep trying, we keep inventing, we keep developing, we keep growing.
Yeah. Yeah. But like you said, there's this parallel system of threat avoidance, that like you have a baseline level of cortisol that is just there, and your brain's looking for ways to turn on the feel good chemicals like dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, etc. But when these spikes pass and wear off, you notice your baseline cortisol, and it helps that to know that's how we're wired, or that these kind of frustrating feelings are part of how we are constructed. So when you step towards things that are new and exciting, like more dopamine, and move away from the social safety nets of the comfortable regular things, and oxytocin goes down, or when you step towards more social importance like serotonin, you might risk some disappointment, feel more cortisol, or strain some of your other social bonds, less oxytocin. So you could see how these trade-offs are part of even the positive important steps in life, and the negative feelings are part of the equation no matter what. And what we're talking about is how to look past that into this broader concept of well-being, and of course how to have a good day on purpose, you know, over and over.
Yeah. Well, I think what you're describing is a great tool for having a good day on purpose. One of which is to acknowledge the sort of biological processes at play, because that can invite some self-compassion. Kind of like I was referencing earlier about just acknowledging that I was tired and it was okay. So I guess another sort of hot tip or pro tip to having a good day on purpose is to spend some time in with self-compassion.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have a human body that's wired to let you know if you didn't sleep well the night before or whatever, because over time, right, sleep is important, and it's important to know how you're doing and what you can engage in and all that, this whole know yourself concept. But if we can learn to like live with those uncomfortable blips and even instead of perceiving them as like reason for panic or an urgent disaster, see them as normal blips in this adventure of being human, then it's much easier to accept and flow with.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Great point.
Yeah. So on the positive psychology, maybe we can look at Seligman's work for a minute, because it's often cited and quite frankly, I like it, especially his later work. Like, I like that he pushed this in an important time, an important way. Back in early 2000s, his Authentic Happiness book and theory was made up of those three main things we've been talking about. Like, you know, the positive mood states, kind of a flow state phenomenon, and a sense of satisfaction. But then I think it was like 2010, 2011, he said, "Hey everyone, I was wrong." Mm. You know, there's something grossly missing from this. And he came out with the next theory that he called a theory of well-being, not a theory of authentic happiness, because it's not all about the happiness feelings. And he called that PERMA, as an acronym for positive emotions, engagement, or that flow, positive relationships, meaning, and accomplishment.
Mm. Yeah, it's, so glad that he worked meaning and relationships into there.
Yeah, and so this well-being concept is like a combination of feeling good as well as actually having like important relationships you cherish that also may not feel good all the time, right? They mm-hmm. they won't. And a sense of accomplishment. He was teaching a lot of students that were very well accomplished in this master's program, and he started to see how there is a drive for mastery. Like, there is a satisfaction we get as humans by sometimes just accomplishing something, and that now gets factored in.
Yeah, I'm certainly a sucker for accomplishment, and maybe that's a product of upbringing as much as it is a sort of just core feature of being a human. But oftentimes I can resolve or address a general feeling of unease by getting something done, by accomplishing something, and then feeling some humble but accurate pride in what I've accomplished.
Yeah. Yeah. So he calls it, like winning mastery or achievement for its own sake, just because that is wired into us. And then, like you said about relationships, they're probably one of the best antidotes to the ups and downs like you experience with your wife. Like, there's no better antidote for a funk than the presence of a supportive other seeing you and caring and offering some validation, reassurance, even ideas of what to do.
Yeah, and there's nothing more painful than reaching out for that and not finding it or being rejected, right? A lot of these things that can deliver on the positive side the most potently, just sort of by that natural process of being a double-edged sword, can also be the ones that cut us the worst.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I've always found it an interesting paradox that, like, as humans, we're so wired to need help, like, from birth and for a longer time period than other species that may, fall out of the nest sooner or maybe born knowing how to walk, run, and avoid prey. Mm-hmm. But yet we develop this terrible fear of asking for help, you know, as our egos form.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of that is socially constructed, right? Yeah. I wonder if our ancient ancestors had that same problem, or at least the problem to the same extent.
Yeah, yeah.
Perhaps we'll never know.
So that's his theory, the well-being theory, mm-hmm. and he describes it in a book called Flourishing that is essentially another word for thriving, right? Mm-hmm. Just getting into, not just the positive feelings, but the whole thing, like being connected to something bigger than yourself and what that does for us humans.
So those are dials you could turn if, you know, you're trying to have a good day on purpose. That's PERMA acronym, I think, is a good guide.
Yeah.
Other things that come to mind, you know, is it Carol Dweck's mindset book, the work on the difference between a growth or a fixed mindset? Remember, every night I gather my family together for, we just call it family time, and we'll go over some just helpful principles or insights. We'll talk about the day. And the other night we were talking about how much the boys have grown, not only like literally physically grown, they're enormous, but how they've grown emotionally and psychologically. And we were joking around about how when they were younger, they had this habit of saying worst day ever, right? They'd come home mm-hmm. from school and just, you know, they'd be venting and we'd be trying to validate, like, this is the worst day ever. And of course, as parents doing our best to provide a great life for our kids, we're feeling a bit defensive because it's like, oh man, worst day ever. Like, we took you to this thing and mm-hmm. we fed you this meal and we had this fun activity. And it was tough because that really, really difficult experience they had at school or whatever, it all of a sudden crowded out all the good stuff. And they felt like it was unchangeable. So this notion of fixed mindset being like, my problems are unchangeable. They're durable. We attribute them to things that are global and specific to us. And at least the correlational work or the survey work that was done by Carol Dweck showed that people who had a tendency toward a fixed mindset generally reported lower levels of subjective well-being and, mm-hmm. More instances of mental health concerns, things like that.
It makes sense because when something happens, you know, we have a choice, you know, close off to it, open up to it, you know, run from it, embrace it and work through. And if you have a fixed mindset and something happens and you take a completely victim-based stance, that feeling of powerlessness, of course, doesn't jive well with a sense of well-being.
Right. So remember, we set the context of being validating about how hard this can be for people and all the reasons to struggle. But, you hear so many stories of people who've had objectively horrific things happen in their lives. And one of the ways they've been able to navigate it and sometimes even thrive thereafter is by using the perspective that you described. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about people who have been paralyzed, for example, and saying things like, you know, being paralyzed was the best thing that ever happened to me. I would see this sometimes when I was in the military and talking to folks who've been severely wounded in battle or lost friends. And they're, if they were able to have this perspective, choose this perspective, like you were saying, you have a choice, then it could really transform the way they saw and interpreted this tragic event. But they could then build on the foundation of the tragedy and thrive.
Yeah, yeah. Thrive and flourish. How do you approach this practically speaking? Like, there's this very confusing science of subjective well-being and positive psychology. There are like studies coming out saying, you know, meditation boosts happiness, and then another one that comes out and says, you know, it didn't in our study or whatever. Mm-hmm. And everyone's studying different things for different purposes in different groups. And it's an ever changing set of, kind of lists and things that might contribute to well-being, but how does one proceed practically speaking?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, the way we've structured this podcast, conversation is also kind of the way I approach this personally and try to approach it with my clients. Meaning, you know, step number one, accept and acknowledge self-compassion. Acknowledge all the things we've talked about, the biological aspects, the social cultural aspects, the things that are outside of our control. And then trying to dissect the difference between what's in our control and out of our control, give grace to and grieve the things that are not in our control, and then really focus on the things that are in our control.
Yeah.
And that can show up in a lot of different ways. That can be deliberate planning of your day. You know, that can be, this is when we get into that, the stuff we were joking about earlier about morning routine, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I know that it's very difficult to feel both sorry for myself and, you know, discouraged and angry and grateful at the same time.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'll pull that long lever of gratitude when I'm feeling really down. And it does make a huge difference. So you could have a deliberate gratitude practice. It could be part of your morning meditation or your evening review. Other things, taking care of yourself biologically is really important. We mentioned sleep earlier. Holy crap. Mm-hmm. Being well rested, getting good sleep, you know, getting your sleep apnea treated. If you have that, you know, these things can make a huge difference. So paying attention to that stuff, being well nourished, eating good food,
yeah,
the kind of stuff your doctor would tell you that we often really sort of shrug off as being pedestrian are the really, really important things.
With the important disclaimer of not sleep shaming yourself or others, there's a lot of talk about sleep on podcasts these days.
Yeah.
Like Matt Walker has brilliant content on the science of sleep. You have these professors like Huberman and others, mm-hmm, talking about how the number one lever you can pull for your life and health is sleep. But what they sometimes don't mention is how hard it is for some people to sleep. You know, whether you are struggling with insomnia related to anything, mm-hmm, like mental health or life circumstances, or just having had a newborn baby, for example.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing we don't want to do is add stress and self-criticism to the equation, because life happens, like you mentioned yesterday.
Yeah, great point. Yeah, a great way to ruin your sleep is to get obsessed with getting good sleep.
Right? Yeah.
And I've struggled with insomnia my whole life, and I've noticed that pattern is if I'm in bed and it's been a couple hours, I can't fall asleep. I'm like, oh, crap, this is going to ruin my day. Mm-hmm. Check on the clock. I got to sleep. That's a fast track to a sleepless night.
You know, remember when I got that Aura ring,
yeah,
for sleep? I have it. I use it sometimes still, but had to take a long break from it because it was just interesting to look at from the get-go. I had it on at first in the daytime because it was fun and I was focusing a lot on HRV, mm-hmm, heart rate variability. And very soon, within days, there was someone else in our clinic down in Springville at the time who had one of those and was egging me on because their HRV was higher than mine. And so I was like, and I felt it. I felt this drive, like, wait, yeah, competitive drive of something that's kind of hard to immediately shift your baseline compared to someone else's, right? And then I would look at my sleep tracking. And at first it was a much needed wake up call of like, I think we often do this. We think we're sleeping better or eating better or whatever than we actually are. Like it's well established in the reporting of what one ate, for example, or I think we both noticed that in our clients, you know, it's really hard to, you know, accurately gauge.
Accurately self-report, yeah.
Yeah, but so then I noticed myself after getting that initial important message that, okay, I do need to work on this, did I really need to see it day after day? Mm. And I was listening to this one podcast. It might have even been like Ben Greenfield or someone who he had on at the time talking about what they did to get the perfect sleep score on their Aura ring. And I was just like, I give up. Like, you know, it's not happening for me at this time to get a perfect sleep score. And everyone's baseline is a little different. I mean, I also was coming from a place of in medical training, you learn to stay up and work every fourth night and then work through the next day and go home maybe at noon or one and sleep and then come back the next morning or I'd work a month of nights. And, you know, those things, they give you the ability to pull an all-nighter, to function in an okay way in times of intense, like needed stress. But, you know, also it's, you know, habits you have to unlearn too.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good skill, but it's not a great lifestyle. Yeah. Beware of HRV elitism. And this is one of the problems I alluded to earlier about this obsession with human optimization.
Yeah.
I remember when you and I first met, we talked about our sort of our shared interest in biohacking and you know, human optimization to a certain extent. I mean, our interest in fitness and things like that.
Yeah. But,
I had to ditch a lot of my wearables, and for a long time, I would watch these reviews on which ones were more accurate about sleep stages and heart rate and body temperature and respiration and O2 sat, all this stuff. And it wasn't adding quality to those metrics necessarily, being too fixated on it. It's almost like orthorexia for health. I'm referencing TikTok too much, and it's probably revealing how much I watch TikTok, but there was this really funny TikTok series where this woman describes herself or, describes her husband as a Huberman husband. She's like, "Oh, I've got a Huberman husband." And she goes through all the stuff that her husband does and makes her do. And like, he's basically trying to do all the things that Huberman prescribes. And it was hilarious in how ridiculous it all was. Like,
that's funny.
Holy cow. Like, your life is what happens to you when you're busy making plans on how to optimize your life.
Yeah.
So I guess the general message being, how to have a good day on purpose. You might want to relax a little bit. Like, you don't have to have control over all those variables, and
yeah,
certainly don't shame yourself for not being optimized.
Yeah, you could see that play out when you're out on vacation. Say you're planning a trip somewhere and you can overfill it and try and control it too much and turn it into a very stressful day. Or you can hopefully learn and settle into that balance of space and intention to do some things that, you know, is more conducive to your well-being.
Yeah. Yeah. Other things you can do on purpose, I guess, just as we're wrapping up, in the interest of being practical and tactical. So I mentioned gratitude. We've talked about other things like meditation and making sure you're connecting with your sources of meaning and relationship in your life, if you've got them. But also, you know, good old fashioned goal setting seems to be helpful for me.
Yeah.
Having at least some focus in my life. What am I trying to achieve? What am I trying to experience? What am I trying to grow or cultivate? And then feeling a sense of progress toward those goals. I used to have quite the video game habit, and some of the video games I would play would give you kind of an artificial sense of that, because they're well-structured, designed by people who understand human psychology, to give you just enough progress to feel like, to be very predictably reinforcing, unlike life. And so, I learned that about myself. And I think a lot of human beings are like that I really like progress, but I was outsourcing that positive feeling to, you know, video games instead of my actual goals. So recalibrating to what I want to create in this life and focusing on my goals, feeling progress toward those goals, can really help me have a good day on purpose.
It's interesting to look at kind of the literature and what comes out, or what has come of the last, I don't know, say 20 years of positive psychology research. You mentioned gratitude, and like, that's one of the things that keeps shining through as something that can push the needle or shift that balance of negative to more positive mood states. But an interesting one is smiling too, just like smiling and what that does. One that I just see time and time again, passing the test of scrutiny in some scientific literature, which I find interesting to think about, just like how many of us practice doing that. And a practical way I've found is just make an intention to smile more at others. Then it doesn't feel so silly, and then it accomplishes the spread of happiness too.
Yeah. I like that. And when we're talking about smiling in this context, is we're not talking about masking, right? We're not talking about smiling even though you feel terrible inside and it feels ego dystonic, but
yeah,
I remember this fun research study about just the smile muscles. So the researchers instructed people to hold, you probably know this study, to hold a pencil in their mouth sideways, so it flexes the smile muscles, or put the eraser in their mouth, and so they purses their lips.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that the instruction was. And then they had them rate, you know, subjective well-being or mood or whatever the metric was. And the people who flexed the smile muscles reported more happiness than the people who flexed the frown muscles. They didn't tell them to smile or frown, yeah. Just flexing those specific muscles.
Yeah, no, that's cool. That's another thing that comes to mind. We've done this in some of our psychedelic studies and with some of our like ketamine therapy retreats and work of like values card sorting tasks to figure out what you really value. But when we're talking about the theory of well-being and PERMA, one practical suggestion I'd give is, and this works for listeners who may be driving and not writing down anything. You can just remember, look up PERMA, the well-being theory, and what those are, the positive emotions, engagement, etc. And then at home, when you have some time to reflect, write those down, write PERMA, say in a vertical line, and fill in the activities that you know will help you personally feel more well-being, because it is a process of self-discovery. I mean, you can look at the literature till you're blue in the face, but it doesn't matter one bit unless you try it on. And, you know, it's just worth noting that it's an individual thing. It what works for one person does not work for the other necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so there's a personal process, a trial and error, and that's just one way to take an inventory.
Yeah. Really good point. Yeah, experimentation is super important to learn that for yourself, because, you know, you and I know a lot of stuff about psychology and mental wellness, and sometimes I need to take my own advice, you know?
Yeah.
It's one thing to know it in your head, to know it academically. It's an entirely different thing to actually practice and discover experientially what's going to work for you.
Yeah, like another example might be, it's fairly well established in the literature that if you were to decide between completing a task on your list or connecting with a human you cherish in a present conversation, the present conversation with a human's going to win time and time again for the most part. But there are also tasks we need to do, and some more meaningful than others and all that. So it is, I think it really comes back to this topic you brought up of how to have a good day on purpose, or how to structure it in a way where there are real life constraints, there are real life forces at play on our mood and our stress. And there are also levers we can pull to feel a little better, even in hard times.
Well said.
Yeah.
Let's go out there and have the rest of the day be good on purpose.
Okay. Challenge accepted.
All right. Thanks, Reed.
Take care.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.